This show is a production of Migration Media. To learn more about us and see a complete list of our shows, visit migrationmedia.net.
From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. Daniela Tormer, founder of Global Nomads World, knows something about migration. Not only is she a clinical psychologist who specializes in helping families deal with the issues surrounding migration, but she's the product of migration herself. Born to parents who had fled from Eastern Europe to Argentina in the early days of World War II, Daniela migrated to Israel as a child and went through a profound identity evolution. Later in life, a move to Europe and then the U.S. meant the loss of her professional credentials, a familiar roadblock for many who migrate. So she did the most expat-y thing next. She started a business to deal with the barrier. Today, she's at the vanguard of a growing movement of mental health professionals who are working to create resources that will help people around the world better deal with the complex issues that arise when they migrate. I learned quite a lot in this conversation. We talked about how people need to deal with their feelings of loss and grief over what they left behind, even though they are going through an experience that is afforded to us only because we have so much privilege. Is it even okay to feel sadness? She also corrects some of my preconceived notions and lays out how the number of people, especially children, who are dealing with issues of identity and cultural assimilation is much higher than what global migrant population numbers would suggest. She really made me think about things in new ways, which I think will become apparent to you in the coming weeks. But that's for later. Right now, just please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Daniela Tormer. Daniela Tormer, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thank you.
Where is home?
Wow. You sent that question, and you know, I've been asked the same question in so many instances, and still I cannot really find a very comfortable answer. So I guess I have more than one home, but it's mainly where the people I feel more comfortable and the people I love are there. So it's my immediate family, obviously. But I also have my extended family. I have very good friends that became family. So it's not a geographical location. It's more an emotional one.
This is great. I love how every answer is different. You're one of the few that refuses to pin down a geographic definition. I like that a lot. So I know we're in your home, your house. Let's not use the word home. We're in your house, maybe your home base. And we're in just outside Boston, in Brookline, Massachusetts. How did you get from where you started to here? Where are you from originally?
So I was born in Argentina, Buenos Aires. But actually, I'm the first generation born in Buenos Aires because my family originally came as immigrants from East Europe to Argentina with the hope to settle down and start really, you know, new life and forever, ever after. But it didn't work out. Political events actually forced us to leave Argentina and led us to Israel, where I lived most of my life. And then just professional opportunities for my husband, I would say, led us to Europe, where we lived for 8 years. And now we're living here in Boston, near Boston, for 3 years already.
Wow, 3 years. So you come from a family of refugees then. That's a lot of moving around for, I mean, I'm assuming the political instability in Eastern Europe would have been around the war or just afterwards or Stalin era, something like that.
In between the wars. So yeah. The lucky ones that actually left were the ones that left to many places, but the ones that stayed in Europe, it's the part of the family that didn't survive.
No. Yeah. So you ended up in Israel, and the time you were in Israel, it was a time of, I mean, Israel is still a massive immigrant country, time you were there, I would imagine it was just even more so. I mean, this is when Israel was really establishing itself and growing like crazy. What was that like? Because Israel is this unique place, whereas there's all these different people coming from everyone's Jewish, obviously, but everyone's coming from different places, and you got all these other traditions, languages. I know there's like a Russian TV channel there. It's really crazy. What's that like?
Well, we could talk about Israel for, you know, a whole podcast for sure, but It was interesting. It is exactly what you said, with the difference that it's not only Jewish, but it's mainly Jewish. And even myself, coming from Argentina, where my family was already, you know, changing in a way, because, you know, part of my family was had mixed marriages. So I wasn't actually very involved into the Jewish tradition. And for me, Israel was a culture shock, all aspects. Obviously, I didn't speak any Hebrew. And everything was new, and, you know, even the way you write everything from scratch. So it was a shock. But Israel has a very unique way to really welcoming you in the most wonderful way. And there are so many immigrants that you feel comfortable with being an immigrant. At the same time, there is an expectation to adapt very quickly, which I did. But then that was maybe the first moment that I felt that there is a gap, or a growing gap, between myself, my sister, and my parents, that they were the traditional immigrants, struggling with the language, sounding really very different from anybody around them. And we were trying to become really Israelis, which I did. And I felt good about it. So that's, I would say, you know, I had to leave behind my Argentinian identity, became a very proud Israeli, served in the army, studied clinical psychologist, married, had 4 kids. Everything was just fine.
Well, Chaim.
Thank you.
So that's actually very interesting. And I haven't explored Israel enough, and just the immigrant culture and the migration culture that's there, because I have a friend who was on the show before who was actually part of the Moshe House Project, which I don't know if you're familiar, but they have homes all around.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the podcasts that I actually listened to. So that was really wonderful.
Yeah, really. That was kind of my first glimpse into, I mean, I grew up Boston Irish Catholic. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. When I graduated, I had Jewish friends that I knew more about Judaism than they do. Like, the Catholics really drill the Old Testament into you, right? So I have, you know, this awareness and this literacy maybe in Jewish tradition, but I'm not obviously involved in the modern Jewish culture. And that was kind of my first glimpse into it. And I realized, wow, there's just this, you know, it is a traditionally migrant kind of culture that is only recently in the last few generations has kind of a homeland. And we can, you know, there's all sorts of politics and whatever about that. But just the idea of, for thousands of years, Jewish people have been migrant by their very nature. And now they're coalescing in a place again. That has got to do something really interesting to the cultural identity of people who are Jewish who go to Israel. I mean, like you said, you had a little tension where you were like, I want to be as Jewish and I'm going to be Israeli. And this is leaving. You said something interesting, leaving your Argentinian identity behind you. What does that mean?
So it means that my main identity would have been Israeli, more than actually the Jewish part. In a sense, when you're in Israel, you don't have to to even mention that you're Jewish, because it goes without saying, and you don't need to make any kind of effort to keep this tradition, because you're part of the majority, which is a very different position from the one that I had, for instance, in Argentina and in any other place I actually lived. So leaving behind meant that I was hiding my accent. When I speak Hebrew, I sound totally Israeli. You wouldn't know unless I would like you to know that I was born in Argentina.
How old were you when you went from Argentina to Israel?
I was 8 years old.
Okay, so you're young enough also. That makes
exactly.
It.
Exactly, yeah. These are kind of years that you are forming your identity and you are exploring different things, and I made a conscious decision that if I want to be part of, you know, the community I was living in, I had to just be part of this melting pot.
Now, this gets a little bit into actually what you do. You're a clinical psychologist, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And can you work with migrant families, expat families, relocating families around these issues of identity? So you moved when you were 8 and you were able to easily adapt. I think anyone who has been part of a migratory family will probably relate to that. Like, the younger children just do better. I know in my wife's case, she's a teacher and she's been teaching first grade the last couple of years, and she talks like that. Like, the kids absorb and they can change a little bit better. What is kind of the, what is the point in age where you find that the children have trouble? Or is there really, is it an age thing? Is it more of a cultural or parenting thing?
There are so many elements that goes into it. So there is a tendency to make generalization about the age of the kids and when is it easier than...
I just did that. Yes. I just totally generalized. Please totally. Tell me while I'm wrong.
Definitely in some occasions you're wrong, in a sense that, you know, it's more than the age, it's the personality of the kids that, you know, we have to acknowledge that they are different, you know, kind of even babies. So, and we are not the same in the way that we can adapt to changes in general. And it can be a simple change as even changing, you know, the location of your place within the same country. But the generalization is somehow correct. The younger you are, the more important the parents are for you. So as long as the parents are with you and they're in, they feel comfortable about themselves and about the decision to move, that gives a lot of stability for the kid. The tricky part comes when you are a teenager, because in your teenager years, you're kind of, you know, separating yourself from your parents and you're trying to find your own way. So having your parents around, that's a good thing. But then if you lose all your peers and you cannot relate to them and you cannot connect to them and they don't know who you are because things are becoming irrelevant to them. So that's definitely, by definition, a more tricky time to make any kind of move. Doesn't mean that you cannot do it. Doesn't mean that you cannot adjust. It just would be challenging. And we have to be attentive to, you know, these challenges. So you're right and you're wrong at the same time.
as is often the case, and as my wife will happily attest to. I mentioned this, that you are a clinical psychologist. You work with a group called Global Nomads World. Is that right?
Yeah.
You started that group?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what you do in Global Nomads World? What inspired you to start this group?
So it's I think it's less exciting. Why did I have to start it? Because actually I was forced to find a solution.
Forced.
Yes, to find a solution to my unique situation. So what happens is when you're transitioning from one country to the other with your profession, it's not obvious that the new country will accept, you know, all your titles and everything you've been doing and the accreditations. And that was...
There are so many stories of like refugees from like Syria or Iraq who had PhDs or
exactly.
were doctors, and now they have to drive taxis.
No, yeah. And this is still till today. You would have thought that by now, with all the globalization, we will have better solutions for this situation, but actually we don't have these solutions. So when we moved from Israel to Belgium, I had to start all over again. I was practicing as a clinical psychologist back in Israel, and I had to start from scratch. It was in times that the online therapy was just, you know, in the beginning. I couldn't even imagine myself doing that, to be very honest. And so I settled in Brussels and started to do different things in person. And then we got this offer to move to Boston. And by moving to Boston, I knew that again, I will have to start all over again. By then, I was really already specializing myself in all this field of, you know, helping families, individuals that are crossing cultures.
Is that what you were doing in Israel?
In Israel, interesting enough, I was touching it, but I didn't do it.
You were probably touching it because everyone does it. It's everyone who comes in has done it at some point.
No, so the difference, I think, back in Israel, when you think about it, no, I was just an ordinary clinical psychologist, you know, building my practice, but with the difference that I was, I had the Spanish as my mother tongue. So anyone that knew any new immigrant that was suffering from some sort of mental issue and they needed to have it in Spanish would refer to me. So back then I was already starting to work, not intentionally, but with people that were crossing cultures. because of the language advantage. So this is the part that I did already in Israel, but that was not planned. Then in Brussels, it started to be more relevant because that was the community I was living in, within the international community. And then transitioning here to the US, the challenge was that actually, even though I'm a clinical psychologist licensed both in Israel and in Belgium, that doesn't count here in Massachusetts.
Ugh, so stupid.
Yeah, well, but you know, sometimes these things are forcing you to reinvent yourself. And I started to think, okay, how can I overcome this challenge and still use all this experience and knowledge I gathered during these years? And that's what led me to open, you know, this company, offering services to expats and not only expats that are spread all over the world, with also the thought in mind that I would do everything online. So in my next move, if I'll have to move, I can take it with me.
Right.
So it's a portable career.
This is something I've noticed with expats and migrants in general, is that when you move, or when you're forced to move, or when you choose to move, whatever, there are barriers that get put in place. There are, whether they're professional, whether they're physical, whether they're economic. And there's always this need or desire or openness to, when you figure out your solution, turning that into a business opportunity, or saying, God, this needs to be better for others too. Like, I can't be the only one going through this. And the natural kind of outgrowth of that line of thought is, well, let's just turn it into a business or a professional organization or whatever. And that way it'll be better for other people. I've seen that so many times with expats. And actually, in the Beijing community that I'm most familiar with, is very entrepreneurial. Like, the community is very entrepreneurial, because right, everyone is trying to start businesses because they see a problem and they're like, well, why can't I just have someone pay me to fix that problem? I did it, and then other people can pay me to fix it for them. It's a natural thing. So when you started this group, and how long has this group been active now?
3 years.
3 years. What are the kinds of services that you offer, and what are the problems that people come to you most often with?
Well, I work mainly with people that are living this kind of lifestyle, but from different reasons. So it's not necessarily the typical expat that we used to think about, like, you know, moving around with a nice package, you know, with all the kids, international schools. Of course, I meet, you know, these kind of families. But right now, you know, there are so many people all over the world that are moving for very different reasons, and also with very different goals. There are people that really wants to become part of the new community. So that will be a different kind of transition when we compare it to somebody that they know that they will be just on temporary basis. I work with all kinds of these nomadic families and individuals. That will be maybe a big generalization, but a lot of people are coming with some sort of symptoms, I would say, of either anxiety around challenges that they face due to this lifestyle, or sometimes depression. It's really a lot to take on when you are doing these kind of decisions. So this is usually what triggers the people to ask for help. And then you find that in the basis of it, there are a lot of problems with identity. So almost, you know, this feeling of not knowing yourself anymore, and not being able to even present yourself, who you are, what do you want to do, what are your goals, where do you see yourself in 10 years? It's so hard not to have a plan. We are kind of, I think, educated to have some sort of plan and to know where you're heading, and suddenly everything can change. So definitely identity and loss. By moving, we gain a lot, and people love to say how much the kids can gain, languages and experiences and so on. But the truth is that for all these wonderful things that we gain, we lose a lot, and we don't necessarily give ourselves the time to grieve.
I also think it's hard to think about the things you lose, because for those of us who can affirmatively make the move, who can choose to make the move, who are doing it not because we're forced to or because we're being driven from somewhere, starting saying something like, I've lost this, or complain, or feeling like you're complaining, or appearing to be sad about what you have, can, I would imagine you'd feel guilty about that. Like, how dare I feel guilty about or feel sad about something when I have this amazing privilege that I can do this. And now I feel sad. What's wrong with me?
And that's so right and so accurate, but it's we are not giving ourselves the permission actually to grieve or to feel bad, because we are definitely the lucky one. We have a choice. So how can we dare? But it's also sometimes the way it's seen. And since I'm working a lot with the Israeli population that is spread all over the world, definitely in Israel, that it's a wonderful place, but it's also a very hard place to live. Whoever lives these days and have an opportunity outside of Israel definitely is considered to be the lucky one and the ones that can make that choice. So usually people around are seen as like having the best life ever. So how can you come back for a visit and say that you had a really hard time? So usually we don't get that.
My wife says that, and she got this from her mother, but my wife often will say, you know, you always grieve change. Even if it's good change, you're grieving at some level the thing that you're leaving behind, because obviously it was good. We had a wonderful life in Beijing, and, you know, now we're in Bali, and Bali's great, but man, my life was awesome in Beijing, you know, and it came to a natural end, my time there, but it's sad to leave. And how dare I feel sad? I'm going to this tropical paradise. How dare I feel sad about leaving this place where I was? You know, it's this weird, I don't know if, well, I think naturally just growing up in a place, you're not taught how to cope with that.
Exactly. There is usually no need. And when you think about it, even in your own case, you will hopefully be very happy in Bali. And still what you have, and it's unique for you, is that you can even imagine what could have been if you had stayed in Beijing. You could have even, you know, imagined how it could have been if you had stayed in the US. So you have many alternative story to think about, to just, you know, this is the complexity of somebody that is moving around. If you had stayed here and, you know, around Boston, you had one strong narrative and maybe one dream of living somewhere else, but without all the content and without this ability to really imagine what does it mean. Now you have it. So when you move around, you're also grieving all this potential other path that you can imagine that you could have had. So it's a lot to take on, and it's complex.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas the people who don't move, or that you leave behind, they're just like, man, he's living in this great place, and they just don't understand. And you can't talk to them about it. So it's also very isolating. So yeah. Even if I know how to deal with this stuff that's going on, and I don't, which is why I'm talking to a clinical psychologist, thank you for the free therapy. Even if I know how to deal with that, it's not something I can go back to my people in my place of origin and talk to them about, because they'll have no frame of reference for what it means.
Exactly. And it doesn't mean that they don't care.
Right.
But, you know, curiosity can take us, you know, some steps, but it doesn't cover everything. So sometimes we feel that, you know, there is not enough interest in hearing our full story. But as you said, there is not an anchor there, so that people can relate to your story. And that's the reason that podcasts like yours are so important, because then we can find, you know, people like us that have similar stories. We haven't really lived. I've never lived in Beijing, but I can definitely relate to that. And it's easy for me to keep on our conversation, because we live similar kind of lifestyle.
Well, I need a moment to process this. So let's have a glass of water, take a breath, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to be much more emotionally stable for the rest of the interview, okay?
Hi, everyone. Want to hear more about the migrant lifestyle? I'm Michelle Ibarra, and I want to give you the tools to live your best life overseas over at my podcast, Pop Abroad. Season 1 is all about global communities and the people who have created and nurtured them. Pop Abroad is also part of the Migration Media Network. You can find Pop Abroad at migrationmedia.net or wherever you find your podcasts.
All right, we were talking about the isolation that people feel, and you helped awaken within me the need that I have to find the tools to deal with this in myself, and I appreciate that, and I'll surely be looking to you for services later. So let's talk a little bit about some of the common problems that you feel that you feel people run into when they're reaching out to you. What are the issues they're dealing with? And one of the things you talked about, we were offline, you said something about language can be a limiting factor, isolating factor. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, sure. So I guess I'm probably representing all this growing group of immigrant, expats, whatever you want to call it, that English is not their first language. And when you're transitioning, you realize that this is probably the language that you need to know, but you're not necessarily moving into a country that this is the language. That was my case when we moved to Belgium. So I was learning French with the idea that I have, this is the language I will need. But very quickly, I realized that my English was more important.
I know from my own experience that English in most of the expat hubs, at least in China, English is the lingua franca as well as in Bali. Most people get around. They come from everywhere, but the most common tongue people will use to speak amongst each other is English.
Which is very true, but what you see around the world is that there are different cultures and community that they rely very much on their own language, and they feel very uncomfortable or disadvantaged in comparison to other expats that they are really capable to communicate in English. So not only you're struggling as an expat, as being a foreigner, as trying to find your way, as trying to practice, you know, as a professional, but also you feel disadvantaged because, you know, you can find, you know, a friend, an expat friend that's coming from an English-speaking country, and you immediately feel inferior. So one of the things I found the most is a lot of expat partners that are moving, following the partner career, finding themselves in isolation. If they are not working, there is nothing that force them to actually take this extra step and cross that bridge and make the effort of really feeling comfortable with the language. And then they stick to their own community. I see it a lot with Israelis. Definitely Israelis feel comfortable with their own communities, and it's always a very warm community that's willing to help. So it's your comfort zone. So why would you challenge that? But I see it also with the Latin Americans that I'm working with. Again, the same kind of language barrier that people have to deal with. When they feel comfortable enough and secure enough to take the risk and cross it, that's usually a major step in their ability to adjust to the new reality wherever they are. So that's very typical.
So you would say learn English before you become an expat.
Or keep it in mind and really, I think, yes, I would invest in that, not necessarily in order to work, but in order to feel comfortable enough and not so lost.
It's fascinating that English is the, like, it really is the lingua franca of kind of the global expat, global migrant community. It's kind of like this, I don't know if I feel good about it. Like, obviously, I come from a country where English is the majority language, and it's a huge advantage for me when I moved overseas. But I have to say, when I got overseas, when I landed in Beijing, I recognized that everyone around me spoke multiple languages. And as an American, I grew up speaking just one. And even though I could speak with everyone, I also understood that there was a level I couldn't get to with everyone because I only had English. And I realized this is a huge disadvantage that Americans have. You know, the younger Americans now who are growing up in, you know, bilingual communities and, you know, the first generation immigrant families where they can speak two languages, I see them as having a huge advantage in terms of just going out and being an expat or a migrant, because it'll be so much easier to, if not become proficient in some other language, but at least they'll be able to more easily absorb and get on the ground floor. So it wouldn't be as isolating. I wasn't isolated, but I felt like the dumb kid in the room. Like everyone in the room speaks three languages and I'm the only idiot who spoke English.
I hear you and I totally can understand that. But believe me, there were so many moments that myself and other people, of course, that I'm working with, I would have switched in a second when I was like so intimidated to really try to teach. I used to teach in the university. And then I found myself, you know, in front of a very supportive crowd and feeling so uncomfortable because I couldn't feel myself. You know, when you don't have the full vocabulary, when you feel that your identity and your personality is not really coming across as you wish it was, it's really hard. Now I'm with you. So now I'm in a state that, you know, after a long journey, I can say I see the advantage. I'm lucky to speak four languages. I'm proud of it. I definitely agree with you that by being forced to go through that process, I think it helped me to have this sensitivity to different nuances, you know, in different cultures.
Just remember when you're out in the international community, remember to be nice to this dumb American who can only speak English. That's just from my own experience. So, what are some of the ways, like you said, a lot of people have issues with, again, the language contributing to the isolation that people feel. That sounds like, and again, I'm going to generalize here and you're going to correct me, but that sounds like something maybe the pejorative term is a trailing spouse might deal with. You know, I'm a trailing spouse right now, proud of it, but I'm also in a place where most people speak English, right? Mm-hmm. Used to be an English colony and everyone's got some level. But it feels like, for people who are following a spouse who has the package, if that's the case, that person is going to have much more trouble than the person who is being sent because they have a purpose. So are a lot of the people that you deal with, is it mostly on the side of people who are following or is it kind of evenly split?
In general, I want to say that it's evenly split, but it's considered to be different. And the reason is that a lot of people are seeking for help for themselves for different reasons. But let's start from the obvious things. So when you're really the one that are following, you know, the partner career, what happens usually is that, let me try to explain it maybe, we tend to think in stories. So the difference from between the two partners is that one has a continuation of the story. So it may be the same company that kind of, yes, in a different place, but still in the same organization, there is like a nice flow and growth. And it makes sense. The other one, it feels like a brutal cut. Like I had a story, it's done, it's over. And then it's just a deep dive into something that I really don't know what will it be, and a new start. So there is no flow and there is no logic. So that's the reason why the ones that are not having this nice flow in the story sometimes end up seeking for help. But the other one has actually a lot of pressure on, because they have the responsibility of taking, you know, the rest of the family through this really great challenge, and they have to succeed. So they have to succeed in their job. If it's also connected to a visa situation, so it's even more challenging.
I'm nodding my head vigorously,
yes,
with that one, yeah.
Yes, and they are transitioning too. So these people, even though, again, they're the lucky one because they have continuation and probably it's a promotion and it sounds so good, it's a lot of pressure. So when I get to work with executives that are going through that kind of process, they feel such a relief when somebody is actually acknowledging the fact that they are suffering too. So I try to work with both sides, and obviously also with parents that are worried about their kids and the way they adjust to the transition.
Now, the kids is where things can get really complicated for lots of reasons, but especially with identity. And this is something that I've noticed and talked a little bit about with people like Tanya Crossman and some parents who've come on the show. But when you have children who grow up, maybe they're born in the place where the family has moved to, and they grow up and they don't even identify with the quote home culture of the parents, that can put a lot of pressure on the adults in that situation, because how do they relate to the children? How do they pass on their own cultural identity? Is that cultural identity, does even need to be passed on? The kids have a different idea of what identity is from the parents. I mean, that is just a whole can of worms. This is a two-part question. Do you find that that's true, and are families dealing with it okay? And the second part of the question is it happening more? Like, what are the numbers like?
Let me start from the second one.
Okay.
So it definitely happens more. So we know that if we are following just the UN statistics, so there are 245 million people right now living outside of their country of birth. But this is just...
That's from 2017 even. We're due new numbers this year.
Exactly. But we are talking actually about much more than that, because we are talking about kids that maybe they were born in the place that, you know, their parents immigrated to, but they're still navigating at least two cultures, because they have the culture at home that can be wherever, you know, if you came from Israel, so they will have the Israeli culture at home, but they will step out and they will have the local culture. So they will navigate these two cultures daily. So these are the cross-cultural kids.
I call them cultural chameleons. They learn how to do that.
Well, or are they not?
So that's the thing.
There are other solutions and other, you see many things. So we tend to think that we are all good chameleons. I think some are better than others. But in any case, the numbers are much, much, much more, because we see that the second and the third generation of that. We also see a growth in, you know, what is acceptable right now in the world, which means that there are much more cross-cultural marriages. So if I will try to answer your first question, it's even much more complicated than what you said. Because if you have two cultures at home, and I think I'm allowed to use my example, so I have my Argentinian culture that I try to keep some elements of it. My husband is Israeli. We do share this Israeli culture as well, so we are kind of, we have it easy. But I have four kids, and each one of them wouldn't necessarily carry their own identity in the same way as the other ones. So each one of them identify themselves a bit different. So the question would be...
Even within the same family,
even
you can
within,
have...
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because you obviously are... If you're moving along, you might have one kid born here, one kid born here.
Exactly.
And then you have the age differences and the... Wow. Yeah.
And again, personality. And then as a parent, the question would be, okay, what do we fight for? And do we agree? Because, you know, two parents, many options, right?
I'm going to jump in here, because this is actually... This is not just profound in your own familial situation, but this actually has profound implications for the planet, like us as a species. So obviously we're still a very small part of the global population, but we're growing, and we're growing really fast. The numbers show that very clearly. If you start to extrapolate your family's experience across the many tens and even hundreds of millions of people that are going through this and will go through in the coming century, that is just going to throw a monkey wrench into the very building blocks that we use as a species to organize ourselves and our tribes or countries. Because what does it mean to be an Argentinian Israeli living in America with kids who were all born in different countries and parents from different backgrounds? Like, what does that do to our ability to form communities? I mean, if we have that kind of mixing up within individual family units, if you have every house on a street is kind of like that, how do you build community around that? What does community look like? What are the common things that you grasp at together to say, yes, we are all part of this tribe and live in the experience together? Like, that's really profound for us as human beings. I mean, that sounds really big, but like, it's different from what we do now.
I couldn't agree more, and we are definitely not the only one talking about it, but it's happening. And part of the reason that it's happening, and it's happening fast, much faster than before, is that when you think about it, so many changes. So even think about mobility. Like 50 years ago, we couldn't really cross countries as easy as we can do now, but now we are doing it, and much more easily. And the way that we are connected through technology. So I can live my life in the way I want, but when you think about it, you know, the people I connect can be spread all over the world. And so the way even we own our, not only identities, but our culture in some way is changing faster than ever before. So yes, this process is growing. I think these kind of questions are becoming much more relevant. A lot of people are struggling, and if I have to make again another generalization, we have like almost two extremes that we try to navigate in between them. One would be, in times of change, we tend to hold on the most familiar thing we have. So this is like going back to the roots. This is like, you know, things like let's be America great again, or all this kind of...
You can point. I think you can draw a straight line between the experiences that people like us are having and the reactionary politics you see on the rise in Western democracies. I mean, yes, the political movements that rise from that are pointing at things like, refugees and people of a lower socioeconomic strata coming into an upper one, which is where they live. But really, that's more than that. I mean, culture is changing around. I mean, in Poland, for instance, the political movement there isn't really so much about the migrants because they don't have many. It's about the culture changing. It's about the West, quote, Western values that have come into Poland since the fall of communism, and how the people who, you know, have been left, quote, left behind economically by the changes don't like these new things happening. And they see the mixed families. They see the business people coming in from other countries and their younger people leaving to go to other places. And that is threatening to them, because who am I if not this?
So this is one example, and this is one side of, or let's put it as an extreme reaction of like, let's hold on what we know and the basics and what was clear and what we did for generations. And you can see it in many ways. The other one would be people that will claim that we are all becoming very similar, that, you know, through the technology, internet and so on, like a teenager in the US will look probably exactly the same as a teenager in some other part of the world, you know, wearing the same kind of jeans and t-shirts, and there won't be much of a difference. So in times we will all be the same. That's the extreme, the other side. And somehow, we have to navigate our own life story in between these two extremes, and we will see in our families different representations and different needs. Some of our kids will feel comfortable with being maybe rootless and connect to this international community. Some of our kids would like to settle down in one very identified place that they can feel that they can belong and feel comfortable with.
It's no less than changing the world. And I'm glad we have people like you out there helping guide people through it. I appreciate it. And I thank you for taking the time to talk with me and not only giving me a little bit of insight into what's going on in my brain, but also unsettling me and opening my eyes to all the crazy stuff that I have to look forward to.
Yes. So thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And of course, I could have continued this conversation forever. And I guess we will.
We will. We will. And I will have links to your organization. I know you did a talk recently in Bangkok. I'll have a link to people for that. They can check it out. But again, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Please check out the show notes for links to more information about my guest and to reach out with questions, feedback, and interview suggestions. Don't forget to subscribe and to leave us a like on your favorite podcatcher. Migratory Patterns is a production of Migration Media and is executive produced by me. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
This has been a Migration Media production. To learn more about the lives of international migrants and see our lineup of shows, visit us at migrationmedia.net or look for us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.